I'm David Kramer. I'm director of the library here at JTS, and we are the sponsors of Book Talks here. We've discovered over the course of time that our faculty attracts a lot of people from the community because, you know, they know us here, and when we have authors from outside the JTS community, we have to guess, you know, concerning, you know, will we get a group? But I have to say, we got this, you know, the inquiry from your publicist when the book was, I guess, first coming out. And when I saw the description of the book, I said, we've got to do this. I mean, immediately. And that's not always the response, I can assure you, because we really do try hard to do proper by the author. But not only the nature of the story, the late war, the occupation of Paris, what comes after is obviously of extraordinary interest to our community, both here and in an extended fashion, but also the fact that one of the characters in your book is a graduate of this institution, Rabbi Judah Nadich, who is a very, very important figure, alum of this institution. And I have to say, I didn't suggest this to you. I mean, family knows that when I first became a teacher here, first as a lecturer, then as whatever comes after that, assistant professor, you know, the next, I actually had an honorary position named after Rabbi Nadich. So I felt very warmly when I saw that and said, yeah, of course we've got to do this. So we welcome you and look forward to hearing about the book, the reading, and I hope a good conversation.
Thank you very much. Now, whether my father heard Rabbi Nadich speak, I don't know. Because my father said very little about his experience as a soldier, and about his experiences in Paris. If he ever went to services, he would have met him. In fact, my father, I remember him saying one thing to me, he never experienced any anti-Semitism at all in his life until he joined the armed forces. So he would have been, driven to seek out his own. I'm going to stand. You won't mind, though, if I refer to. So how did this start out? I was going through a box of my father. I'm the only child. So when my father died, I had to basically clear out the apartment, and I in Florida, of course. And it was very, very hard for me to do because there was all their stuff. Now, my father, to his credit, had all the papers for me, from automobile insurance to veterans affairs, alphabetized in a single file cabinet. But then there was all the rest of the stuff. So it took me, over time, 2 years on vacations, and I got it cleared out. And as I was leaving, I remembered they had an outdoor storage area. So I went to that, and it was a box marked memorabilia, in which were thousands and thousands of photos, most unlabeled. I'll pass this one around. This was a very interesting one. Most were unlabeled. I mean, it took me 2 weeks just to separate them into decades. There were some that were, they're from Russia. Most were unlabeled. Occasionally he would label, like he took a picture at a zoo of a zebra, and on the back was written, Zebra Zoo. Thank you, Dad. Well, this was a picture. None of the pictures came as a surprise to me. I knew that he had been in the war. I knew he'd been in Paris. There were pictures of him, you know, cutting up in Paris. Like, he's lounging on the grass in a park right next to a sign that says in French, no stepping on the grass. that was his sense of humor. But there was a picture that I had never seen before, and this is the one that's coming around. He did jot down in pencil names of people. They were not familiar to me. He told me about some of his exploits during the war. So, for instance, he would go to the PX, the post exchange, and he would buy whatever he could, whatever he was entitled to. Soup and cereal and powdered milk and toilet paper, anything he could get. And then he would go around and distribute it to Jewish civilians. Hmm. Because actually, even though the Nazis did this incredible sweep through Paris and Inverness, a lot of Jews lived right there in Paris under their noses or lived in hiding, or they started to come out. So he would just give this things away to other people. He was in Paris for about 2 years. He was never in a combat unit, although he was trained for combat. He had flat feet, and they said, you'll never withstand a march. So they said, you work in the postal service now, you can do the postal service now, which was great. And this was the postal service that would send letters to the soldiers and packages and would also censor things coming in and going out. So when I found the photo, it was a challenge. Researchers think a certain way, and challenges then become obsessions. So here's a picture of my father with three adult women and a child who looks to be a young adolescent. I figured, well, my father's gone, so these adults may all be gone. I wonder if I could find this child. And I figured I didn't have much of a chance because of the time lapse. I wrote a letter. Well, I didn't write a letter. At the time, I didn't have any French. So I had a colleague do it for me, write a short letter saying I'm the daughter of the soldier. And I sent it to everybody in the French phone book I could find, with that last name, which was an unusual name. It was not French. It was Polish. But I still had about 30, 35 people to mail it to.
I mean, what last name?
Stroz.
How did you have this name?
He wrote it on the back of the picture. He actually, if he didn't write it, I would have been, you know, up a creek. But
Stroz?
Yes. Which is like Strauss.
I know someone in New York of that name.
You know, and it's a name of a big law firm,
yes,
Stroz Friedman.
Yes, mm-hmm. I know.
So I tried to track, well, not in this country, but over there. So most people didn't answer because people don't answer mail from strangers. Some people wrote back and said, I showed this to my grandmother. She doesn't know anybody. So people did try. And then one night, like in the middle of the night, I got this phone call from a man who was crying when he heard my voice. Mm. And finally he stopped and he said, Sergeant Al. Because I had not mentioned my father's first name in the letter at all. Mm. So, you know, I still get chills when I talk about it. And then he didn't speak very much English, and I spoke no French. Mm. So I learned French. I had to give up my studying of Yiddish at the time because it was hard to study two languages at once. And we started to talk. Then I went over to meet him. So he showed me all around Paris, and I was trying to squeeze information out of him about my father, because I felt that I didn't know my father very well, certainly not the younger man, and most of my information about my father I got through my mother, so it wasn't direct. And I got as much as I could. So, for instance, I said, how did my father happen to pick your family out of all the Jewish civilians in Paris? He says, oh, he came looking for us. Hmm. I didn't know that. So we traced that. Finally, I get the whole story. But it's not enough for me, because I wanted to find out what it was actually like for him, for his mother. How had they survived the occupation? Because in walking around Paris, and I wasn't familiar with Paris. I'd been there you know, once for 3 days after college graduation, you go and you see a gazillion cookies in 2 weeks. And so I was in the Marais, the French, you know, the working class district. It was a working class street. Now it's full of boutiques and. But I saw on one building it said, "This person lived here in 1924, was arrested and executed. This person lived 1942, another person 1942." And what did people do? They just sat there and waited. Yes, because you had an ID card with your address, and Jews were forbidden to move. And I couldn't ask him a lot of questions all at once, because he did not want to talk about the war. He does not like the war. He has pulled away from everything Jewish. And I risked his wrath if I pushed too hard.
What was his relationship to the picture, to the woman in the picture?
This is his mother.
Okay, the younger woman?
This is his aunt. Uh-huh. This is his grandmother.
Okay.
And so, you know, my father and he were chums.
So how old at the time he was, maybe 14?
He was 12. Actually, he had his bar mitzvah the following summer. Mm-hmm. And I know my father went to the bar mitzvah because Georges told me, you see in this, there's another picture. He says, I have a wristwatch. I have a wristwatch that your father gave me for my bar mitzvah. So I had this compulsion to go to the synagogue where he had his bar mitzvah. I went in. I visited almost every place associated with my father's visit. So I was thinking, what am I going to do with this information? And I kept doing more and more research until I felt that I had learned enough to understand what life was like for the Jews under the yoke of the Nazis. And it was suffocating, because you never knew who was going to turn you in. It could be the friendly family downstairs in your building. It could be somebody at work. A woman I got to know in Paris told me that one day a policeman came to her apartment and said, "Madam, I am coming back tomorrow to arrest you, and you are going to be deported. So if you heed my advice, you might put some things in your bag and leave now, and don't come back. Oh, but before you go, put on some makeup, some lipstick, and walk out as though you have not a care in the world. And don't make eye contact with the lady with glasses on the first floor." And this woman is alive today because she was tipped off. I went to Drancy. I went there to see what it was like. And this was it was supposed to be a working class housing for workers. And they hadn't quite finished it. It was in a C shape. So they just strung barbed wire around it and put prisoners in there. And so, of course, over the course of 4 years, almost all of the 76,000 Jews who were deported and killed by the Nazis spent time there. And now it is it's a working, it has plaques up, but nobody notices it. And so I spent a lot of time visiting France and becoming angrier and angrier, because there's a 50-year gap between monuments of the war. This here fell this policeman or this soldier or this in defense of Paris, and then the markers in front of the schools, or an aside alley where I went. This apartment house, the following people were taken from this building, and their names of women, children, 6-month-old baby. And it just happened, and nobody bothered to look at the plaques. And the reason the plaques are even there today is because of the Klarsfelds. who have done, you know, all this incredible work. So I came to write the story. I had all this information, and I think I must have read almost everything published in English about the occupation. And I decided simply to write it as fiction. And the reason I wrote it as fiction is, one, I'm not a historian. Two, we don't need another historical analysis of what went on in the Holocaust. And if I wrote it as fiction, I could change some things, but I could also make it more palatable to a wider range of people. And it's like a lot of people did not know about the Veldiv Roundup until they read Sarah's Key. So I decided I would try this as fiction. And yes, I have written books before, but they're academic, but they're still written as, you know, it's a story. It's not, you don't write books purposely to make people fall asleep. So I wrote, it took me 2 years. I started it, but then after I retired from my last job in New York, I was able to work full time. And sometimes I would get up and I'd have written 5,000 words or 10,000 words. It just depended upon the day. So I thought I would share a chapter or two with you, and then we can discuss things.
Mm-hmm.
There are two parts to this book. In the first part, we meet this American soldier. His name is Ben Gordon, and he works for the Army Postal Service, and he goes to Paris soldiers don't know where they're going when they're assigned. They find out what theater they're going to, but they don't find out what they're going to do until they do it. Which is why I read your father's diary here in the library, because he was the official chaplain for the Jewish forces, and I wanted to see what it was like from his point of view. Just watching the handwriting deteriorate as this, because in London it was fun. You know, you're getting ready to do the invasion, and aside from being blitzed, you know, there's really not that much work, just some training. But once you get into a country and you find out the conditions of people, how people were living, it's another story. So in this, in the first part, Ben goes over, he gets involved with his family, and the father and the grandfather have both been deported. Nobody knows exactly to where. There are rumors, but nobody is quite sure. So I'm going to read a little bit of this book. And if you were watching on TV, I guess in the last week or so, there was a big anti-Semitism rally in Paris in the Place de la République. Mm-hmm. And there's a big statue of, you know, Marianne, who's the symbol of France. So there, that's actually where this scene takes place. Ben knows Simone has every right to be enraged. The two most significant men in her life had been taken away. She had had to live undercover for almost 3 years, and she felt betrayed by her own country. Mira, who's the mother of Simone, who dealt with the same losses, was simply quiet, except for when she was with her grandson, who made her eyes shine with delight. Ben is at the Duval apartment again for dinner, and has brought another large box filled with goodies from the PX. Ben, you are too generous. By the way, when they speak in English, they're actually speaking in Yiddish. But I have to write for who's going to read. Ben, you are too generous, Mira had exclaimed as she opened the door for him. It's courtesy of Uncle Sam. Your uncle sends you these things? Ben laughed. No, U.S., Uncle Sam. It's a nickname for the United States government. These are all things it provides for us soldiers, and we are happy to share with you. After the dinner dishes are cleared, Ben helps with the washing up and then suggests they all go for a walk. After all, he says, he has not seen very much of Paris yet, and he would love a little tour with actual Parisians. Mira says that she is rather tired and will stay home reading with Guy, but she encourages Simone to go out with Ben. Get out a bit, Simone. Breathe the free air. I know you will be safe with an American soldier to protect you. She and her daughter laugh, and Ben is not sure whether he's really seen as a protector or has been given a warning. Don't worry, Mira. I will deliver Simone to your doorstep unharmed in a couple of hours. They set off in the direction of the Place de la République, two blocks away. Many others just like them are also out walking, enjoying the freedom of open streets and the ability to be outside without a curfew. Simone and Ben are silent as they approach the long plaza with the dramatic white stone statue of Marianne, the symbol of France, at its center. There was fierce fighting here just before the liberation, says Simone quietly. One of the women I met in our lobby told me about it. She said the Germans used a building on the far side of the place as a barracks, and they holed up in there, shooting hundreds of Parisians from the windows. Look, you can still see where crosses and bouquets were set out at the spots where people died. Indeed, Ben now notices the small crosses, still visible in the fading light, set up in various sections of the plaza. It's so lovely here, it's hard to imagine that just a few weeks ago the war was being fought right in this very location, he says. They walk to the center of the plaza, picking their way past rubble, and find seats on a stone bench beneath Marianne. In silence, they watch lights come on in Paris as the western sky darkens. The city becomes more twinkly each minute. It does not look like what it has been for the past 4 years, a dark place of fear and death. Simone is very quiet, and Ben is afraid to speak. I wish I could speak to you in French, Ben finally says in Yiddish, but you speak so fast. Ah, because you have schoolboy French. Well, I was a schoolboy when I learned. Simone laughs. Technically, I was the same. Mama and Papa came here from Poland, and aside from Yiddish, they spoke Russian, only when they didn't want me to understand. I learned French when it was time for school. Mama and Papa learned French also, but they speak it with Polish accents. She stops abruptly, then after a moment, spoke. I don't know if my father still speaks. With his illness, I can't imagine he has survived all this time. They are silent again for a few minutes. Ben pulls a pack of Luckies from his jacket pocket. Voulez-vous a smoke? She shakes her head. I'm happy I never took up that habit. People who smoked, during the occupation, they had a hard time, unless they could pay the black market prices. Well, they must be happy now that they can get their hands on American cigarettes. Only if the Americans are nice and give them away. I've heard that some of your soldier friends have created a little black market of their own. Selling stuff from the PX? That's completely against regulations, said Ben. A soldier could be court-martialed for that. Simone laughs briefly and makes the little derisive French pfft with her lips. Regulations. People do what they want. She pauses, concentrating, and she stares ahead at the dark sky. And they do what they need to do. The pain in this last statement makes Ben wonder what exactly Simone had needed to do to get by during the war, and if she has been holding something back. He has met relatively few civilians so far and hesitates to ask too many questions. To survive under occupation, one had to keep a low profile, or fight back, or go along with things. From what he has heard, there were only a few kinds of Frenchmen, those who fought in the French army and were captured, civilians who had been killed, and those who were in the resistance, and those who had collaborated in some way with Vichy and the Nazis. How had people managed who were just trying to get by? What about old people on pensions, or students preparing to graduate but without employment ahead? Women left on their own to work or to look after children were vulnerable to the occupiers or collaborators. His mind goes back to the shocking event he witnessed with Solly. He wants to break the silence that hangs in the air. He needs to say something, but does not want to upset Simone further. Simone sits quietly next to him, her shoulders slumped in exhaustion. She looks off into the distance and then slowly begins to speak in a low voice. It's almost impossible to describe what it's been like, Ben. The last 4 years have been nothing but rumors and gossip and fear. We were afraid of the Germans, but not of the French. We trusted the hero of Verdun. How could we not believe the reassurances that came from Pétain? Everyone revered him. Maréchal, we are here. Maréchal, we are here. They made the kids sing that in school. Merde. There was only one thing we knew for sure. Things would go badly for the Jews. If things were bad for the French, they would be worse for the Jews. Did all the Jews feel this way? Asks Ben. Not at first. She pauses, thinking. Well, how do I know? I only knew my family and friends and the people in our neighborhood. I was born right here in Paris, so I am used to French ways. But my mother and father and Jacques all came to France to avoid the hate and the danger and the beatings. They thought, France, liberty for all. Simone's voice breaks as she quotes the words Ben has seen engraved on every public building. Liberté, égalité, fraternité. She leans forward on the steps, arms around her knees, and weeps softly. Ben does not know what to say. Simone's bitter outburst makes him think of his own pledge of allegiance, and its concluding words, with liberty and justice for all. Not the way that worked out, either. Even the great liberating U.S. Army was segregated. But what good would it do to tell Simone that other countries, too, were hypocritical? He wants instead to stroke her arm to remind her that the French really were free now, that things would improve, but he does not want Simone to think that he is using his sadness as an excuse to touch her. And after all, she is a married woman, and he is engaged. He has still not told this to Simone or her mother. No, he will do the right thing and wait for the right moment, but this certainly is not it. Now the best thing he can do is simply listen. We were so blind, says Simone. I think Jacques knew that things would go badly, but my father was more optimistic. He really believed the French people would protect us. It sounds like they didn't at all. From what I've heard from some others since liberation, yes, actually, many did, even some of the police. Simone's tone has perked up a bit with this relatively hopeful response, but Ben hears the acidity of her indignation quickly seep back into her voice. But others were all too happy to denounce Jewish neighbors and see them dragged away. Maybe they are just bigots full of hate. Or maybe they want your apartment or your wife or the money they'll get paid for providing a name or two. Ben shifts uncomfortably on the hard stone step. Simone speaks to him slowly and deliberately. You have never had to make a choice in order to survive, have you? Ben shakes his head. No, he has not. You have no idea. She looks silently ahead at the city growing darker as the sun continues its descent. Then she turns back to Ben, her expression grim. Yes, without those papers from Helene, she had been given false ID papers, Mama and I would very likely be dead, maybe Guy too. Ben merely listens, feeling ignorant and ashamed. Why hadn't the Americans believed all those early rumors? Why hadn't America tried to intervene and help? He struggles to recall details of the congressional debates about military action, and he remembers reports about the persecution of European Jews not being treated seriously. With those papers, Simone continues, I had a new life and could hide Mama and Guy myself. But the stress was incredible. I don't think I can even give you an accurate idea. I was afraid all the time, constantly. Only when I slept did I get a little relief. And even then, the dreams. Her voice trails off. Ben has heard all of this before, but tonight Simone's story seems much more personal and intimate with just the two of them than it did with her mother and son in the apartment. Still, he is not sure of what to say to comfort her. It must have been very hard to stretch your ration coupons. Ration coupons? They were the least of my worries, Simone replies, her voice somewhat derisive. It seems she feels this particular conversation is different somehow, even though the subject is by now well-worn. She needs to vent her emotions, but she also worries, but he also worries that he might be saying the wrong thing. Well, no, because worrying about food became a total preoccupation in Paris. I could never do anything that would get me into any kind of trouble. No gossiping, no complaining, no buying a few extra eggs when it was possible on the black market. I couldn't have my identification card scrutinized. What if I were caught? I couldn't alert Mama. She didn't exist, as far as the authorities were concerned. If I did, she would be off to Drancy too, with me not far behind. And then what would happen to Guy? Ben feels chagrined, even though nothing that Simone describes is his fault. The temperature has definitely fallen in the last half hour. Ben takes off his light wool khaki army jacket and drapes it over Simone's shoulders. Here, he says. Thank you, Ben. Look, I am sorry to make you listen to all of this, but I've really had no one to talk to. Yes, I had my mama, and we love each other very much. But I could not tell her everything and make her fret even more about how frightened I was on the metro, because the police would arrest people at random to hold as hostages, or about the foreman at the workshop who offered me black market bread and cheese if I would... Oh, don't look so shocked. A lot of women accepted offers like that because they had children to feed. Have you seen some of the women who have been accused of sleeping with the Germans? Bed nods, remembering that scene near the Rue de Turbigot. Well, some did. The Germans, after all, had the very best. Wine, cheese, eggs, meat. They requisitioned the best hotels, the nicest houses. So if Parisians wanted to eat well, they collaborated in different ways. Yes, I have heard about this. He does not want Simone to feel like she has to give him any more details. Maybe, also, he does not want to know. Small tears have begun to appear on Simone's cheeks, tiny droplets reflecting the glittery city lights. I had to be so careful all the time. We knew the newspapers were really controlled by the Germans, but we took them seriously when they mentioned regulations and punishment. After German was assassinated in the metro, that's when they started taking civilian hostages. Anyone. They said if a German were attacked, a certain number of hostages would die. Later they would print the names of those who were shot. So I had to keep my eyes open and avoid being trapped anywhere. Ben squirms in his seat, trying to ignore the aching void shaping inside of him. Simone continues, staring ahead. I never wanted to be first out of the metro or last. If I saw they were checking identity cards ahead, I just kept going because I knew they looked for people turning back. I never missed curfew. I worried about Mama because her health is not good, but I could not bring a doctor to her. I felt relieved about Guy when he was in the village because he could eat better there, but I worried that someone would see that he was circumcised. We're finally safe, but I am so, so tired from being on alert all the time. I am tired from having to be two people. Simone finally lets her tears flow freely, and her whole body shakes with sobs. Trying to remain strong for others all those years has come at a huge price. I'll stop at that point. I have the second part of the book. The first part ends inconclusively. Ben goes home, and Guy grows up. In the second part of the book, Ben's daughter, who is not like me in any way, finds the picture and traces the boy and tries to get Guy, who is now an old man, to express his feelings. It's very hard. Mm. I can read more. I can keep us occupied. But I thought you might have some questions, or I could tell some of the other things that I learned. But you probably all know about what things were like in Paris during the war.
Yeah, something I read just recently stressed what you just said, that people, though, even those who weren't actively collaborating, still had to survive and go along. And were just simply, that's what living was like in Paris, in France, occupied France, occupied mm-hmm. Europe in general at the time.
Well, I remember the first time that I was visiting my friend Georges in the 13th. I was walking down his street, and you know, I just read every plaque because I don't want to miss any history. And it said on this plaque, in this building was held the secret meeting of, it was like August 16th, 1944. It was the police on their a meeting to discuss the, you know, striking back of the Germans. And I mean, I look at that and I just kind of snorted, because they could probably hear the guns coming in from the north and the west of the invasion. And, you know, they didn't rebel in 1942 or 1943, but a week before the invasion.
Then they could say they were a resistance fighter.
Yeah, right.
What was it about when the liberation of Paris took place?
There were people fighting at the moment of liberation.
August. Mm-hmm. It was August 44.
So you said that your father never spoke about this to you when you were growing up.
Right. He spoke about bringing things to Jewish civilians. Mm-hmm. He met a family. It was an older mother, an older father, and an adult daughter. And he helped them too, and when he had to leave Paris, because the army sent him to Germany for a while first, the father wanted to give him some jewelry in exchange. And my father said, no, I can't take that. And the man said, you must take something, and gave my father a yellow star, the star that he'd had to wear. Mm. So I have that at home. You know, framed with a picture of my father, which I'll give to one of the children. And that's really all I heard. We have a German wall clock. It's not a full, you know, grand. And my father said he got it in Germany. Maybe he bought it. Maybe he took it. I don't know. You know, but it's when I took the things apart, when I took the house, the apartment apart, I took the clock down and I looked on the back, and there was a handprint in the shellac, you know, of somebody who'd worked on it. And I thought, I wonder whose handprint that is and how he felt about the Jews. Yeah, it's just, to me, everything revolves around that one question.
After this whole process of going to Paris and meeting these people and then writing the book, how has this affected you in terms of that relationship?
Good question.
As I was finishing the writing of the book, things were starting to percolate in France and other places again. And since the book has come out, it's been, and this has made me feel, I see things going around in circles, and I feel very angry and frightened and distrustful. Mm-hmm. And now, of course, we're overly informed about everything, but we're sometimes misinformed about things. And I'm glad that I've written this as a novel, particularly if bright high school students, you know, read something like this. things can happen again. I'll give you an example. Sometimes I substitute teach just because I get a kick out of it. Yeah? So I was substitute teaching. This is in North Carolina with some high school students whose assignment was to read Elie Wiesel's Night. And the teacher had written at the top, just have them continue reading. Don't teach them anything.
That's a useful use of your time.
Yeah, right. Don't teach them anything. And I thought, yeah, all right. So I said to these students, why are you reading this book? These things happened 80 years ago. You know, 70 years ago. Why are you reading it now? And I just wanted to see, you know, what kind of response I could elicit. So a group of kids had a lot of questions. And this one girl asked, why didn't our American soldiers go in right at the beginning and fight, you know, the enemy? And that this was wrong. These were all Hispanic kids. There were no Jewish kids in this in this class. I mean, if you're just judging by names and... So I said, well, when are most of these actions taking place? Before the Americans got to Europe. Americans didn't get to Europe until after D-Day, 1944. Oh. And so they're, you know, well then, you know, who was going, why did they do it to these people? And I said, well, let me give you an example. If something is repeated, is told to you, by somebody who's an authority, over and over and over again. After a while, a few weeks, a few months, a couple of years, you start to believe it. So, if somebody in the government, I'm just speaking in general, I said to them, because I didn't want any trouble. I said, let's say somebody in the government says, you know, the reason our economy is so bad and so many people are out of work, it's because of these Hispanic immigrants. So this one boy stands up, he says, but that's not true. I said, of course it's not true. You know it. We all know it. I know it. But if somebody says it again and again, and not to Hispanic students, but to other students, again and again, over and over and over, instead of fixing things, they tell a lie repeatedly, people will start to believe it because it's easier to blame some people than to fix what's wrong. Oh. You know, I just was just planting the seeds. Mm-hmm. I wanted these kids to think. But I am afraid it's going to happen again. And personally, it makes me want to be very proactive and not say, oh, you know, it'll dissipate. Things will get better. No, I don't think things will get better unless we do things, unless we advocate. And that means at the first sign.
Right. So before there are problems.
Hmm?
Before there's a...
Yes.
Before there are fissures within the society.
In my question, I was going in a different direction.
Okay.
Which is, what did you learn about your father?
Oh, what did I learn about my father?
That you didn't know. Did you know that he was such a generous and kind and that kind of person?
I think he was. He was generous. If someone said, I need something, he would try to supply it. Being Jewish was very important to him. He did not have a lot of Jewish knowledge. My parents were not observant. They did not belong to a synagogue. They did not keep kosher. They didn't light Friday night lights. But they were Jewish. And it was very, very important. I think I'm a more active Jew than my father, but it also told me things about my father. I learned that my father would help people, but
Why he kept this a secret from me, this particular family, I can only theorize. I have theories, but I have no way of proving any one of them. And what you're thinking, I'm thinking. But I don't know.
No, I didn't have a question. Yeah. I was just...
What appears with your children's reactions been to this book and the process and the research and so on?
They said, how did you learn about all these things about Grandpa? I said, well, I actually didn't. I had to do research to find out the circumstances. I know what Grandpa himself did, but I had to find out the circumstances. And, of course, whether my father was the one who mobilized all the other soldiers to set up the... I don't know that. I'm just elaborating.
In the book...
Well, I probably have some personal reasons for that. I wanted my father to be more heroic in my eyes than I think he may have been. I wanted him... But yet, his greatest fault... which I know about, was that he was indecisive. He didn't want to hurt anybody's feelings. So he couldn't make, well, if I do this, this person won't like it. But if I do that, this person.
You're talking about the kind of reality substrate of the book, what is fictionalized from... which is one element of the relationship between reality and the novel, the fiction. As you read, I was also struck, and you said this after, you said you folks probably know, kind of what happened.
Right.
And as phenomena, we probably do, right? We're not going to learn history from what you read.
Right.
Right? But it struck me that what you were able to do, what I did learn, was emotion. That... listening to it in the fictionalized exchange of two people who were feeling very deeply the variety of complicated things they were feeling, that's a discovery that you can't get from reading a history.
Likewise, I think it's one thing to know the statistics.
Right.
This many men were murdered and this many women were... But then you see... the schools, and you see the homes. I remember years ago, my husband and I were visiting Amsterdam, and a friend of mine set me up with her brother-in-law. She said, you've got to go on his tour of Amsterdam. So he took us to see Anne Frank's house, but not the hiding place.
Oh. Really?
The apartments, the garden apartment complex, where they had lived before... invasion.
We saw the
that. Yeah. I mean, I've seen the hiding place, but seeing this just, it looked like Queens. It was a little garden apartment with a little grassy area,
beautiful
in the
park out front, right?
And exactly. It just looked
nice life.
It just looked so normal and so ordinary that I found that chilling. So when I see places where people actually lived and where people actually hid, and I could actually see an apartment house from the point of view of the concierge, a lot of apartment houses were built around a courtyard, and the concierge had an apartment, just inside. The concierge could look up, and concierge knew who was in every apartment. And if you had a good concierge, she would warn you or would hide you or would not give out information. If you had a bad concierge, she'd say, oh, you want you?
Yeah, there are a lot of apartment buildings in Paris that are built that way.
Yeah.
Is there another short section that kind of strikes a note that might strike us?
I think so. I haven't prepared. Because this is in the second part of the book, where Judith, the daughter, goes to Père Lachaise. Has you've been to Père Lachaise?
Yeah.
What is it?
It's the cemetery. It's a, one
historical
of the cemetery.
Cemetery.
But it's historic.
Oh,
in Paris.
In the,
yeah.
The north.
No, no,
yeah,
that's the
no,
other
no.
one. Père Lachaise is on the other side of town.
Right.
No, that's
Mont.
No, no, yeah, it's they're the two main ones. You're thinking of the second one.
Is that the one?
Yeah, that's
Paris?
Yeah, no, that's Père
Lachaise. That's Père Lachaise.
That's right. But they're
and
authors. It's Paris. They're authors in both of them. And artists.
Is that the one where Chopin is?
It is the one where Chopin is, okay. is the one where Proust is buried.
Okay. That sounds good.
Very
yeah,
modest.
There are several.
Yeah.
And
Oscar Wilde, too.
Yeah.
Oh. Oscar Wilde is buried.
Yes. And James Morrison.
Jim Morrison.
Jim Morrison. Yeah, Jim Morrison. The Doors, you know.
Yeah. Okay.
The Rock's interesting.
Yeah, well, in our family, we call him Jim.
Yeah.
Okay.
I remember that.
That's right.
Okay. Is this short? This is very, very short.
Okay, great.
By the way, I'm going to mention Elizabeth Shuttleford. Is anybody familiar with the name of the 19th century writer, Elizabeth Shuttleford?
No.
I made her up. Okay. But the other names are actual mm-hmm. names. On a morning she has to herself, Judith decides to visit the Père Lachaise Cemetery in the 20th. Not that she's a big fan of graveyards, but she has been to Mount Auburn in Cambridge, Massachusetts, to see Charlotte Cushman's resting place, and Highgate in London to see George Eliot's grave, leaving her pen embedded in the earth there with many others. And of course, she has been to Elizabeth Shuttleford's when she made her literary pilgrimage. But everyone at home has told her she must see this, one of the oldest, certainly, one of the most famous cemeteries of Paris. Judith has heard from her colleagues that Père Lachaise is actually a tourist destination, and she passes couples and groups armed with maps, like the ones sold in Hollywood, to those seeking the homes of the stars. It is not merely a cemetery with remarkable sculptures, but also the final resting place of many celebrities, ranging from Molière to Jim Morrison. Having no map, though, Judith simply wanders. From a gate on the cemetery's eastern side where she enters, she strolls across a crowded plateau, the leaves of tall trees shielding her from the sun. She passes Simone Signoret and Yves Montand, who sleep under a plain flat marker. Religious symbols adorn many gravestones, mostly crosses, ranging from simple to ornate, intricately carved Celtic designs, while a few bear the Star of David and Hebrew lettering. These are interspersed among the others, along with an occasional Muslim or Buddhist grave. Judith bends down and collects small pebbles and stones for remembrance, placing them on the Jewish graves as she wanders through the rows. She realizes she's simply following the ancient custom because she's programmed to do it. I am in a place I've never been, she thinks to herself. And yet I'm remembering people whom I do not know. Without realizing it, she is searching for the oldest Jewish graves. Judith descends carefully along winding paths over a hilly area to a circular garden, then down more hills to the main entrance. Here she slows her pace, as she would risk a certain fall on the twisting paths that are often crossed by ancient tree roots. She cannot read inscriptions and walk at the same time. She has read that when Père Lachaise opened at the beginning of the 19th century, some people thought it too far from central Paris to be chic. No one wanted to be buried there. So a marketing scheme was devised to relocate some celebrity graves. The plan worked, and the new cemetery became the resting place of choice. She continues meandering past family tombs with more than one generation interred. Sometimes all the names are listed on the outside, sometimes not. Judith sees numerous memorials, Christian and Jewish, to sons lost in the Great War. One features a life-size bronze statue of a soldier in uniform, rifle in hand, facing east toward Germany. Down another hill she steps and finds an open area encircled by a fence. She walks around it to learn that this is a memorial to those French Jews who have no marked graves, those murdered in the Holocaust. Judith has been wandering for well over an hour, although she hasn't looked at her watch. She is almost at the edge of the cemetery, for she sees a gateway in the distance. This is an older part of Père Lachaise, shaded by tall trees whose roots have made the paths uneven and probably have created a jumble beneath the ground. She is drawn to a large structure in one corner as it dominates this area. So this is the tomb of Abelard and Heloise, who died hundreds of years before the cemetery was established. This must be one of the relocated interments placed here to draw company. The move obviously worked, for this section is crowded with tombs and monuments. Judith spends a few moments among these graves before she realizes they are different from most of the ones she has seen so far. There are no crosses. She studies the names and symbols on the graves and family mausoleums. Hebrew lettering and stars of David indicate that this section of Père Lachaise is predominantly Jewish. She walks the length of this row and approaches a tall, simple, and imposing tomb. There is only one name at the top, but it is a forename, not a family name. Rachel. Judith wonders if this could be the resting place of the famous 19th century actress, a contemporary of the English Victorian actresses Helena Fawcett and Mary Ann Sterling. She remembers that in France, Rachel's reputation rivaled that of Sarah Bernhardt. She pauses and takes from her little bag the notebook she habitually carries, jotting down Rachel's name to remind herself to check later. Then she turns back to study the names more closely. Several are recognizably Jewish. Kahan, Levy, Levy. Some names refer to the French cities where Jewish families lived when they were ordered by Napoleon to take surnames. Lion or Leon for Lyon. Many families' names have Germanic origins, people who came to Paris from the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Schloss, Heilbronner, Bernheim, Kaufmann, Sachs, Gompertz, and Lehmann. Among these is the tomb of the Dreyfus family. This monument she sees includes more than one generation and has a notation, mort en deportation, for family members murdered in the Shoah, died while being deported. As she moves down the row, Judith recognizes some surnames as Sephardic, such as Amar and Naraf, belonging to Jews who came to France from Spain or Northern Africa. Again, Judith spots monuments to young men who died in battle, mort pour la France. She sees the same family lost two sons in World War I, one at the Somme, the other, younger, at the Battle of the Marne. Now she finds the oldest Jewish graves. Here is Joseph Enriquez Raba, born in Bordeaux in 1793. Not too far away lies Joseph Bernstein, born just a little later in 1797 in Warsaw. The actual earliest date she finds is 1785, the birth year of a Parisian Jew whose name, on a worn, very old stone, she cannot decipher. The names Judith reads are as diverse as the places from which their bearers originated. Ullman, Samuel, Singer, Berl, Natan, Oster, Mai, Hirsch, Schustermann, Balin, Haas, Schwab, Hernsheim, Cerf. She remembers seeing some of these same names on the walls of the Memorial de la Shoah. Judith has been at Père Lachaise for almost 3 hours, and now she is very tired. She is exhausted, but knows this has little to do with her age and the day's heat. She is overwhelmingly sad. Retracing her steps back to the tomb of Rachel near the main gate on Boulevard de Ménilmontant, she exits and spots a bench. She sits in the shadiest place she can find. She wishes she had a good friend like Claudette or her brother Michael with her now. Certainly, she cannot tell anything of what she has seen or feels to Guy. For two centuries, the Jews of Paris have buried their dead here. 10 generations have become part of the Parisian soil. Many families lost sons, brothers, and fathers defending France in the Great War. Yet in the 1940s, so many thousands. She recalls the many inscribed walls she saw at the memorial were methodically rounded up and deported. How long, wonders Judith, does a person have to live in a place before not being considered the other? She looks down and is surprised to see her hands clenched into fists.
Thank you.
Thank you.